The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
So what's changed permanently? I think that we've had a big discussion about the balance between privacy and security. My sense is that that was a well-worked piece of territory before June 5th of 2013. You look at many of the programs that have been widely disparaged, 215, and much of what essentially is the construction of those programs demonstrates a fealty to privacy as opposed to a headlong search for security. The fact that 215 is restricted to terrorism, does not include identity information, doesn't include content information, can't be used for any other purpose, and even then only very narrowly proscribed purposes. That's all about the defense of privacy. What's been missing, right, in that calculation is what's the right contribution of transparency so that people understand the balance that we have between privacy and security, and that we can sustain the consent of the governed, or in the case of the summer of 2013, the consent of those who govern. Right? You know, my surprise in the summer of 2013, what was the broad consternation outside of the intelligence committees about what NSA did, how it did that, and whether we were in the right place.
I'm Wells Bennett, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, April 5th, 2014. You just heard Chris Inglis, the recently retired Deputy Director of the National Security Agency. On Wednesday, Inglis gave an address at the National Security Agency at the Crossroads, a two-day conference organized by Lawfare's Bobby Chesney and held at the University of Texas School of Law. The event allowed for terrific and close engagement between senior NSA personnel and academics, and just as important, the conference also featured speeches that we'll soon post as Lawfare podcasts. Our own Benjamin Witt has caught up with Inglis after his remarks at the conference. The two spoke in depth on a variety of subjects touching the NSA, the agency's stance toward reform proposals, Inglis's own reaction to the controversy that followed the Snowden revelations, and the nation's enduring effort to protect both privacy and security. You'll hear all that and more on the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 69, Chris Inglis on the NSA.
So let's start with the 215 proposal from the administration. In your judgment, is this adequate to preserve NSA's real equities here and the capability that you find important, or is this going to leave us in a bad place?
Yeah, so that's a great framing of the question. First and foremost, I would say that NSA doesn't have equities that are separate and apart from the nation. Whatever choice the nation makes, right, through the whole of governance, the application of appropriate dialogue and the exercise of governance as intended by the framers of the Constitution, whatever conclusion they come to, that's what NSA will faithfully do, so long as it's consistent with the Constitution and the laws that derive from that. So the question then becomes, you know, what is the president attempting to do, and what will the Congress then do? My sense is that in his speech on January 17th and in the subsequent work that's transpired, they're trying to preserve a national security capability, but they're trying to do so in a way that achieves a greater transparency and therefore confidence that we've got the balance between privacy and national security right. And in so doing, I don't think what we're looking for is a different balance between privacy and security, but a better understanding of what that balance is and some greater confidence that it will never be abused, that we won't let one run roughshod over the other. There are four attributes that you then care about in a program like that, whether it's metadata or the collection of any other material. First would be, are there sufficient controls in place to guarantee the privacy of the innocent persons whose data is collected and stored in such a thing? I think that the kind of formulation that's come out can in fact provide for that. Implementation will be important, but we'll need to spend some time and attention on it. And the other three factors have to do with the efficiency and effectiveness of the national security purposes. Is the pile of data deep enough that it goes back far enough that you might discover an incipient plot that's 2-3 years in the making but has recently gone quiet? Is the data broad enough such that if you query, right, this data set, you'll have confidence that an answer that's returned is an authoritative answer?
Now, let me stop you right there, because one of the things that I've been sort of struggling with personally in thinking about this is that in some ways, at least, the data might be broader under the proposal than it is under the current program, at least as that program's been described in certain press stories, because of inhibitions about collecting certain types of metadata with respect to geolocation. There's actually significant gaps in the current coverage. And I've written or speculated that there may be actual operational advantages to the proposal that the president has put forward, in that it would be broader in coverage than what is now being collected. And I've been sort of flirted with the idea that maybe this is a win-win from a civil liberties and operational point of view. You get, the civil libertarians get the end of government maintenance of the database, the end of, you know, bulk collection, and no time restriction on how long people, the companies have to hold the data. So the companies, there's essentially no program. On the other hand, what the NSA gets is much more comprehensive coverage. I'm wondering, is that wrong, or is there operational advantage to doing it this way?
I think that's entirely possible, if not probable. I think that it's now been disclosed that the government has not been acquiring 100% of the data that's authorized under the court's interpretation of the 215 mandate, and in large part, because the government has exercised an abundance of caution to make sure that the data it gets is exactly conforming with the orders of the court. And so if in kind of pursuing new kind of contributions of that from other providers or from other modes, say mobile communications as opposed to just landlines, the government realizes that that's problematic because other data might come along with that. It has taken the time necessary to get that exactly right, which means that today we're only collecting something on the order of, I think the last term that I was familiar with was about a quarter of the total set of data. So you're right, you might in fact be able to now access much more of that. You might have a much then more authoritative answer if you query, right, the data set wherever that might be held. The thing that might then be the trade-off for that is that you might have less agility in the speed at which you're able to acquire those answers. But that's not an unfair trade-off, and if that's the choice made, NSA will support it.
So if you're choosing between the longer tail time-wise and greater agility, and shorter, less agility and a shorter tail time-wise, but greater substantive coverage, just as an operator, which do you prefer?
Yeah, so I wouldn't want to drive it to the kind of the end of that spectrum, but I said, you know, within reasonable limits, I would drive for breadth and depth, right? You make sure you have, you know, all the data such that you get an authoritative answer and you can look far enough back to catch plots that are long in the making over agility. But there's a reasonable limit to that. If the consequence was that I have no agility, that I can't get an answer short of a week or two or three, that would be problematic. And there are some studies that actually indicate whether you need this in hours' time or weeks' time.
Now, so one of the other questions that I've just scratched my head about here is the determinant of agility is both bureaucratic and, you know, what the nature of the judicial oversight is, but it's also what form the data is in.
That's right.
Because absent that, you could just do it with national security letters. It doesn't a lot for the vitality of what the president is proposing depend on whether there is a sort of unified format that all the companies can hold data in that enable intercompany querying once you've satisfied whatever process that, I mean, how essential is that to the operation?
If agility is a factor, right, if timeliness and response is a factor that matters to you, and I think it is, that's very important. That can be engineered, but it turns out it won't self-engineer. Right? These companies hold the data for their own purposes, for varying lengths, in greatly varying formats. There's no requirement that for their own purposes they need to keep it on paper or reel-to-reel tape, index cards, right, in a kind of searchable database. And there's no requirement that they do it the same way company to company. To the extent that it's different or it's harder to access using a common tool, it will slow down the process of acquiring and reconciling the data across multiple vendors. And so I think that there'll have to be some engineering work done, possibly at the companies, right, to make that a quicker proposition.
But you're confident that it's doable?
I think it's an engineering issue, not a kind of can it be done issue.
Uh-huh. So a year ago, you were somebody that nobody had ever heard of, who was quietly the deputy director of NSA. And then June 5th happened. I'm just sort of interested at the highest level of altitude in your sort of reflections on the last 9 months and what it means for that agency to go through what it has gone through and what it should have done differently, what its mistakes were, what it did right and was treated unfairly about. You know, how do you look back over the last few months and what do you see?
Right, so I knew in early 2013 that 2013 was the final year of a career for me, and so I was looking forward to that being an opportunity to essentially continue through to the end with a full and fair contribution from my small part. What I knew on June 4th, I still knew on June 6th, which was that NSA makes an important contribution to the nations and frankly to the coalition of nations security. That did not change. The harshness then came from the doubt that was instilled in the minds of many, many people across the United States and frankly across many allies that NSA might have lost its way. And what we had to remain focused on in the summer of 2013 and into the fall was how do we continue to execute the mission, right, that continues to be important, vital, and noble in the face of extraordinary doubt that we were executing a mission that was, in some cases, perceived as valuable at all. I thought that there was a greatly skewed telling of the story. The focus was almost wholly on capabilities and what might be done if those capabilities were abused or misused. There's very little conversation about then what the authorities, the controls, constraints, and frankly the ethos of an NSA is that essentially makes it such that those capabilities, in my view, are appropriately applied to the nation's purposes. The workforce, fortunately, or unfortunately, as you might say, frankly knew going into June 5th, 2013, not that that would happen, but knew already that there was a proposition other than are we popular or not? Are we well paid or not? Do we have swell parking or not? All of those people who show up at NSA and other organizations within the federal government know that they could probably have easier lives, more popular lives, more well-paid lives if they took those talents elsewhere. And so they're there for some other purpose. Generally at NSA, it's a purpose that includes, not trivially, the opportunity to make a contribution. And the important bit for me, General Alexander, and others was to make sure that they continued to know that they kind of believed that, and they did. And they hung tough, and they saw their way through right the summer and fall of 2013, continuing to do that work. So what's changed permanently? I think that we've had a big discussion about the balance between privacy and security. My sense is that was a well-worked piece of territory before June 5th of 2013. You look at many of the programs that have been widely disparaged, 215. And much of what essentially is the construction of those programs demonstrates a fealty to privacy as opposed to a headlong search for security. The fact that 215 is restricted to terrorism, it does not include identity information, doesn't include content information, can't be used for any other purpose, and even then only very narrowly proscribed purposes. That's all about the defense of privacy. What's been missing, right, in that calculation is what's the right contribution of transparency so that people understand the balance that we have between privacy and security, and that we can sustain the consent of the governed, or in the case of the summer of 2013, the consent of those who govern, right? You know, my surprise in the summer of 2013, what was the broad consternation outside of the intelligence committees about what NSA did, how it did that, and whether we were in the right place.
So talk to me about that. I mean, I have been A, very critical, and B, very criticized for being critical of members of Congress who, in fact, had a lot of opportunities to know what was going on and passed up a lot of opportunities to know what's going on, or maybe even subsequently misrepresented opportunities that they in fact took advantage of. How much of the shock that came out of Congress in that period, in your judgment, was, you know, Casablanca shocked, and how much of it was real surprise that, you know, was perhaps stuff they should have known, but was stuff that they didn't know because maybe they didn't think about hard enough or didn't process? How do you read what happened in Congress last summer?
Yeah, I think most of it was the latter. Most of it was shock and dismay of being confronted with a really complicated set of technologies, authorities, operational practices on the part of wily adversaries. I'm trying to reconcile all that, put that together and say, is that all completely consistent with the laws as written or as intended? Has NSA faithfully executed all of this? I think it's remarkable, right, that a Democratic senator in charge of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence agreed wholeheartedly with a Republican congressman in charge of the Congressional Oversight Committee on Intelligence, and included in their kind of cohort, right, staunchly defending NSA, avowed, you know, members of the Tea Party. That's a very strange ideological combination. And so it was less about ideology, it was less about reflexive responses to ideology last summer than it was the true consternation of people who, when confronted with an X key score or a PRISM or a 215, didn't even know what those terms meant at some kind of exalted executive level. And therefore, given a story that says that these have been horribly abused, and no one telling another version of that story, kind of could only conclude that there is just the possibility that these things are in fact out of sync. And they responded to that, as human beings do. You know, the thoughtful wonks amongst them said, well, we need to slow down, we need to understand this, we need to have a fuller understanding of all the facts that are on the table. And frankly, we're now getting to that 9 months later.
So you just listened to a panel that I moderated of a bunch of reporters who have worked on this story, none of the ones who have received the documents, but reporters who have been engaged in this story for the entire time, whom I asked to evaluate the institutional performance of the press, and they gave a variety of different, varyingly self-critical and self-congratulatory answers. I'm wondering how you evaluate this, you know, the NSA's preferred degree of engagement historically with the press is zero. For the first time in your life, you were the subject of, individually, but your agency was the subject of intensive press coverage. How do you evaluate the discussion that the press generated?
First, kind of talk a little bit about the antecedent, you know, what was transpiring over a year's time that not enough of us, and I put myself in this category of not having given enough time and thought to the implications of this trend, essentially understood. And that is that we used to essentially practice disciplines like the SIGINT discipline, what NSA does in its intelligence mission, in places that were physically a world away, right? And most of the American public could have little care as to what we were doing to essentially kind of tease intelligence out of what most folks would say that's truly a bad, right, you know, organization, a bad thing. It's truly their networks, not ours. And so, you know, more power to you. I'm sure that's being properly overseen by somebody. But please don't bore me with the details because they're horribly complex and it doesn't concern me. And the insidious thing is that those networks, where we once did that work, whether it was in World War II or the Cold War, became over time the same network where innocents, not just innocent Americans, but innocents abroad, conducted their daily lives. And increasingly a place where they stored their wealth and treasure. You know, their secrets were stored in that space. And when it then became suddenly apparent as those two worlds merged that NSA was not overseas or world away, but it was conducting foreign intelligence missions by essentially dipping into the same global infrastructure that was used by innocents of all stripes. That was, to some, shocking, and certainly to most, surprising.
And were you aware, as that storm is developing over the last you know, 15 years, and the away game and the home game merge, were you aware that there was, you know, a developing thundercloud, set of thunderclouds, that the moment the first drop of rain starts, that this is a big storm? Or was this just an evolution that kind of crept up on you all?
I think it was more the latter. So would say that I was certainly aware that the merger was taking place, and I and members of the executive branch, legislative branch, judiciary branch were essentially opposing controls, right, to account for that merger. Right, the 702 legislation under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 2008, frankly, is as much about how do you impose controls on the execution of a foreign intelligence mission in that common space than how do you liberate an NSA to operate agilely in that space. I can see both parts. But when the stories began to roll out in June of 2013, the telling of that story was mostly from the standpoint of what the capabilities were, not the controls imposed on them, not the constraints, and certainly not the ethos and the culture that must go hand in glove with that.
And sometimes not even the use.
Not even the use. And so it was instructive to me. You know, I certainly understood this the first week of this rollout, that what was being described in breathless terms was something called the secondary order, which essentially kind of allows NSA to have access to this material. But there's in fact a primary order, which talks all about the prescribed uses, the proscribed behaviors, the controls, constraints that go hand in glove with that. And you can't really understand this totally unless you at least understand those two artifacts, and frankly much more. And so my view of the press's behavior in this is that they too often took the bait of going to the worst possible corner in terms of if you have a bias that government is exceeding its authorities, and you're looking for data to support that, it's possible to find data that kind of feeds that that interpretation of the world. But we all have an obligation to consider the totality of data and to figure out whether in the kind of full explanation of what's transpiring, we essentially have said, do we actually have a reconciliation of all these perspectives? Until we get to that place, we should be less willing to perhaps decry or call out, right, you know, the perceived misbehavior of one party or another, and more desirous of trying to figure out, have we actually had the full dialogue so that we can make the proper choices about how to achieve a balance we prefer and move forward.
So what are the pieces of the dialogue that are missing right now?
I don't think we've had enough discussion about the true nature of threats in the world. Now, that can become, you know, very quickly an excuse to perhaps practice national security means and methods, you know, in excess. And so I don't mean by that to say I've got some compelling stories that will sufficiently alarm you that you'll let me do anything I have to do. But we have to talk about the predicate that motivates the government to put programs like this in place in the first place.
So give us the overview of that predicate. What is the case for the idea that given the merger of the away game and the home game, that you can't conduct aggressive surveillance against foreign intelligence targets without touching a lot of A, domestic communications or domestic to foreign communications, and B, the communications of a lot of innocents abroad, that the right answer to that problem is, you know, empowering NSA with constraints rather than not?
I think the question is beautifully framed. It's almost rhetorical. I think that's it. Is that you have to recognize that adversaries, you know, people, organizations who mean to do us harm, and us in this case is not simply the United States, but those that we're allied with, and they make use of the same communication services and devices as innocents, tens of millions of innocents. And so the choice for us is, do we then say we will not engage in any surveillance of, you know, the bad things, bad persons, bad organizations, bad efforts in the world, because we run the risk of actually encountering innocence in there? Or do we somehow adjudicate, control that such that we can achieve the fair balance? And I think that we have to figure out how to do the latter, because even our own Constitution says that it's not about national security or civil liberty, it's about both, right? We have to achieve both. And the population expects its government to deliver both national security and civil liberties. You might choose the order of those, you might choose the balance of those, but you can't choose one or the other. And so given that, I think that we need to have a fuller discussion about what are the national security imperatives, What are the unalienable rights that our citizens, and by extension through policy, innocent citizens of the world have? How do we achieve both of those? And the expectation of an NSA should not, in my view, be that it never encounters a U.S. person or an innocent in the world. That's impossible. That's an intractable problem. But that it knows precisely what to do when it does, and faithfully does it, and not simply based upon its own assertions that I have or have not done the right thing, but with appropriate external oversight and constraints and controls that are then provable, right, to some reasonable degree, across three branches of government and to the population beyond.
So when you say that the missing piece of the conversation, or a missing piece of the conversation, is the larger threat environment, how would you, just broadly speaking, describe the larger threat environment?
Yeah, so I think we need to look kind of in the larger context at what actually is happening. Let's take terrorism. It's the iconic threat. It's not the only one. James Clapper gave, I think, a pretty good summation of threats in the world in his February 4th testimony before Congress, the Senate, in open session. That's a good place to look to see what perhaps might be a characterization of that today. But we sometimes look too local, right, to say, is there or is there not a threat? Some would observe that there not being a foreign terrorist act in the United States for 13 years, going back to the 11th of September 2001, that would show cause as to assume that perhaps we're past that, right, that there is no threat to the United States in that regard. But when you expand your horizon and look at what then is still transpiring in the rest of the world, there were 15,500 deaths attributable to terrorism across the arc of instability that is the Middle East, Southwest Asia, and large parts of Africa in the single year, I think it was of 2012 alone. And much of that was aimed at Western interest. Much of that was aimed as a desire to take that fight to the United States and its allies, but did not succeed because I think that we've been largely successful with a set of security institutions, not just NSA, but many institutions and allied with other governments in holding that at sway, holding that back. I think that you have to then consider the possibility that those institutions have been successful to some degree in holding that threat back, but the larger threat is still there. And a fuller examination of that would say that we're not past this yet. We may never be past this. And that's not throwing caution to the wind to say, therefore, it's national security overall, but national security still has a place at the table.
So when I talk to NSA people or other people in the business of doing security, they talk about, as you just did, the absence of successful attacks, a generally successful security climate in the terrorism space. When I talk to civil libertarians, they have a completely different vocabulary for the same thing, which is, show me the individual attacks that were thwarted as a consequence of individual programs, if you want me to believe that the individual program is effective and successful. I have struggled to reconcile these two vocabularies, and I think it just can't be done, because I think there's some very basic first principles that are different between people who speak in the first language. And so when you talk about, in the long run, about sort of ensuring enough transparency and accountability so that there's effective consent of the governed, one of the things that I sort of wonder about is how do you get consent of that part of the governed that wants a very particularized showing of very particularized effectiveness for each constituent programmatic activity without either saying things that you don't know to be true regarding the role of the individual programs in good outcomes, or revealing a whole lot of information about those programs that would then compromise their function?
Yeah, I agree that that's hard to reconcile. And I think it's less because we are unable to speak in classified venues or to disclose classified information than it is attributable perhaps to other factors. One of those is our desire is not to catch terrorists at the cockpit door, or to catch them in airplanes, or to catch them in market squares within, you know, the United States of America. But we'd actually like to kind of interdict these threats much, much earlier than that. And frankly, in the world I want to live in, we want to make it less likely that we'll even have terrorists kind of born and raised, that the conditions that give rise to that sort of extremist behavior will be swept away, and that, you know, we won't even have to worry about the kind of movements that give rise to that. But that's not where we live. But we are, in fact, I think, more successful in pushing back the time at which we discern something that might be arrayed against us and interdicting that, you know, as it's perhaps in its incipient phase. And so that then gives rise to people saying, but nobody's been caught at the cockpit door. Nobody's been found to be in a market square with a bomb in their hands. Doesn't that then mean that the threat's gone away? No, it might well mean that we're being more successful in the fundamentals, right, of pushing back, right, on those things that give rise to this. The second challenge, right, that lives in this space is the fact that no one of these tools is meant to and should be expected to succeed alone. That what we have are many, many tools in the toolkit that essentially are intended to complement one another. In the same way that for kind of another matter entirely, but I'll just give this by way of analogy, right, we have the Department of Homeland Security attempting to make the nation more resilient, more robust against all manner of natural threats and to an increasing degree, some degree of cyber threats. But side by side with them, you have all manner of local police forces. You've got the North American Air Defense Command providing other forms of national security. They complement one another. No one of them stands alone. And it's very seldom that you can say that this particular institution, with their narrow slice of authority, entirely kind of detected and defeated some particular threat. That's particularly true with 215, right? The collection of that telephone metadata is merely intended to discern and tip, right, the existence of a foreign threat, terrorist threat, projected into the United States, and tip that to the FBI. At that point, right, the application of domestic law enforcement authority or investigative authority is supposed to take over. And frankly, then the 215 program is supposed to recede properly to the back and not come in for a lot of praise, because all it did was to essentially give you a clue that there's a thread worth pulling out of this sweater. I mean, to then hold it accountable for not on its own, in and of itself, right, defeating kind of broad swaths of terror is an unfair standard.
And what percentage of the value of 215 in your estimation is the tips that it generates? And what percentage of the value is the tips that it doesn't generate and thereby provides confidence that things aren't happening?
Yeah, so both of those are valuable. I think that we publicly testified that it was employed for the 54 plots that were discussed in the summer of 2013 as having been disrupted using a combination of 702 and 215 authorities. 215 was only potentially useful in 13 of those, because only 13 of those plots were aimed at the United States. It was actually used in 12 of those, and it turns out 8 of the times it returned no information, right? Essentially telling the FBI, there's no there that is worth pursuing. Concentrate your resources somewhere else. That's very helpful in a world where there's only so many resources, only so many things you can pursue. There's only so many beat cops you can put at the edge, right, of some kind of threat scenario. And if you have confidence that I don't need to cover that quarter because the intelligence says that's not a worthy pursuit, that's hugely helpful. In 4 of the cases, it did return, right, a thread or a tip to the FBI, and they could double down and concentrate resources down that neck of the woods. But in both cases, it's more an insurance policy against the extreme possibility that we might have missed, right, this threat into the United States through a variety of other means and methods. The 911 Commission observed that that was a seam that, at least in one instance, we missed, and but for want of it, you know, only kind of a reliving of that history, which we'll never have the ability to do, but for want of having catched the crossing of that seam, we might have stopped 911. That's really an insurance policy, and I've got an insurance policy in my house that I've never had to use, at least with respect to its fire policy. The fact that I've never used it doesn't mean that I want to then throw it away, because there's still that remote possibility I might one day need it. And I think that it's more that. That doesn't justify then gross, strong encroachment of civil liberties or privacy. We need to understand that it has a limited utility in national security. It should therefore be greatly restricted in the encroachment it might make on privacy, right, civil liberties. And my sense is a fuller telling of the story would observe that it's just that.
One of the most interesting comments you made last night, one that I really hadn't thought about previously, was the deceptive quality of geography in the context of cyber threats. I mean, we always hear about this in the context of attribution is difficult. But you put up a slide, which I'll just describe, which contained a series of DDoS intensity graphs relative to locations in the United States, Britain, and Australia in which there were major financial centers, and maps of where the attacks were coming from. And then you asserted that the actual attack was in fact originating from somewhere entirely different, and that was somewhere on this map that in fact showed very little activity at all. I'm interested just for your sense of what, how we should understand geography. So much of our law mm-hmm. is predicated on a difference, the difference between the foreign and the domestic. So much of our law is predicated on the idea that a different set of rules applies overseas and to overseas people than to domestic, than applies here and to U.S. persons. Is it a sustainable difference if you don't know who you're dealing with and what their citizenship is and you don't know where people are?
It is a sustainable difference, and I think in large part because we've declared that we must, right? So we have declared under the Constitution of the United States that there are certain unalienable rights that we extend to our citizenry, and by policy we extend that to others in other nations. And so those distinctions matter. There certainly must be distinctions between people who are innocent and therefore not deserving of the time and attention of NSA and people who perhaps are attempting to conduct acts of terrorism or other things that threaten our national security. So despite the fact that the geography of cyberspace makes it hard, right, to distinguish between and amongst the identities of the true purposes of people, we have to work all the harder to then layer that, to actually apply that. Which is why in that model that I showed, which is hard to describe kind of in audio here, I said that we need to understand then the bias that geography brings to us. We need to understand the bias that we actually impose in terms of, you know, what the kind of distinctions between and amongst people gives to us, and understand that cyberspace doesn't naturally extend those right into the way it behaves, that it runs roughshod over geography, it runs roughshod over the distinctions between and amongst persons. And that then gives rise to what then do we do to then bring to bear a reconciliation, right, of that? How do we achieve security and privacy in the same space? As opposed to people who would say we can rely upon geography because it's naturally extended into cyberspace. We can rely upon the distinctions between amongst people because that's naturally extended in cyberspace. It's not, right? And therefore my argument is don't expect NSA to simply conduct its business on the networks and against the communications that are intact and separate from the communications of innocents around the world. That's not the way cyberspace really works. Do expect that NSA will respect the distinctions between people, respect the distinctions that are often ascribed to geography, and do its damnedest to figure out how to actually bring those to bear in a domain that makes it hard.
So what does one do after being Deputy Director of NSA? You stepped down a few months ago, taking a break. What's the future for you?
I don't honestly know. I tell my friends that I'm in the survey mode of my life. I signed on to the Department of Defense when I was 17, and 41 years later, kind of January 2014, kind of dropped out of the Federal Civil Service, right, having been a public servant all the years in between. I enjoyed that immensely. I was proud to be able to do that even through the last year of 2013, because like everyone else who joins that or kind of any aspect of public service, federal government or otherwise, there's a larger purpose. And so that was always a sense of pride for me. And so that hasn't gone away. I still have a sense that there must be some then further contribution I might make. At the same time, I enrich my life with a diversity of other experiences that I haven't had the chance to do. So that might then cut across to some possibilities in academia, some possibility in advisory capacities, and certainly be a member of this public dialogue, which continues to be really important. How do we reconcile? How do we achieve at once, right, the privacy, security, and transparency that we're all looking for out of this? So I don't know what I'm going to be doing precisely, but it'll probably be centered around those multiple objectives.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Yep, thanks very much for your time.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music was performed by Sophia Yan. As always, please do spread the word about Lawfare on social media. And, of course, thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.